Talk Radio, where God matters, looking at all life through the lens of the Scripture and the teaching of Christ Church.
Cresta in the Afternoon, weekdays from 4 to 6 on 990 WDEO. Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Professor Tony Esselin of Providence College, where he's taught since 1990. He's become well known over the years for much of his writing. The centerpiece, though, of his book publishing are the three volumes of The Divine Comedy, which he published in 2002, 2003, 2004, I believe, for Random House. They're now in the Modern Library edition that is to be found at most bookstores. It's a wonderful translation. I read it when it came out. Tony, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thank you, Deal. Thank you for having me.
Here's what I want us to accomplish today. I want us to convince everyone listening that they should go and read some Dante.
Yeah,
can we do that?
Yes, we should do that. People who are listening to our radio program on should avail themselves of the greatest poet who ever lived. If we consider Shakespeare a playwright and not a poet, it's Dante. We have the greatest poet who ever lived, and we have his greatest work, The Divine Comedy.
And you know, one thing that I want to get into before we get to the text itself is this looks like something. I mean, it's a long poem, and it just encompasses everything that was going on in the world of history and philosophy and theology and literature in his time and so forth. How did this spring up? I mean, we sort of understand Aquinas' Summa which was earlier, but because there was a tradition of scholasticism that looked like that going back several hundred years. But in Dante's case, were there any precursors to what he did?
Yes and no. The answer to that question is no. If we're looking for is a comprehensive epic poem in the vernacular in Europe in the Middle Ages that would deal with all questions of human society and morality, philosophy and theology, that's not there. But works of literature that did have a very expansive range that were profoundly theological and philosophical, even while they were purporting just to tell us a story about Lancelot and Guinevere and the other knights at the court of King Arthur, they certainly did exist. So what Dante has at his back is a really vibrant medieval literary tradition that examines the deepest questions that human beings can ask, and he also has at his back a 200-year tradition of love poetry, which he himself in his youthful years advanced mightily by combining that tradition with questions that you might find in Thomas's Summa,
like in La Vita Nuova.
In La Vita Nuova, right.
Yeah.
And so those things are at his back. So he's got a rich heritage to spring from, and then, who knows, the personal encounter with the beautiful...
Beatrice.
Beautiful girl Beatrice, yeah. It's and he was, Dante's a unique genius, and all the stars align just right so that we can get something utterly unlike any poem that had gone before in a certain sense, and yet with its roots deep into medieval, very vibrant medieval Christian culture.
What inspired him, though, to take a man from hell to purgatory to heaven? What inspired him to structure a poem in that way? I mean, I find that a fascinating sort of out-of-the-blue work of art.
Well, there had been not nearly so wonderful as Dante's, but there had been apocryphal visions of a famous one, which Dante was aware of, the apocryphal vision of Saint Paul, gone to hell, and you know, you go down there, you tell of what you see, you bring some knowledge back. So that too was in place. I don't know. I mean, it seems as if it were readily available for somebody to take up. That is, if Christian life is conceived of as a pilgrimage and an adventure, and it was by St. Augustine, pilgrimage metaphors all over the place, in Augustine especially. And if it's an adventure, that is, we are waiting for the wonders of God's grace to come to you in this life, and that's what it is in the Cistercian quest of the Holy Grail and a lot of the Arthurian romances, then it would seem that almost it's waiting for somebody to put those two things together. And
sort of like Aquinas did for philosophy and theology.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's time for
a synthesis.
A pilgrimage? How about this for a pilgrimage?
Yeah, it's time for a synthesis.
Yeah.
And it maybe was the last century in the West when it would be possible for somebody, one person, to do that.
Everything else, well, for a couple of centuries hence, you would have people who, in the shadow of Dante, who would attempt to do something like what he was doing, but of course nobody could pull it off the way he did. And the last person that fits into that category is a very different poet who owed a lot to Dante, and that would be Milton in Paradise Lost.
Yes. But who, by the way, I don't appreciate as much as I do Dante.
I'm a lover of Milton.
Okay, we might have to talk about that on another occasion.
He's a greater poet.
I mean, I love his sonnets. But now, so you have here an epic poem, which is three volumes, at least in most, you do get single volume editions. It's a big book. It's a long poem, but it's very readable because it lays out in short sections.
Right.
And it translates well. Now, you chose a blank verse format
at the time,
and rather than the what's called the terza rima, could you tell our audience, you know, what's the difference between what Dante did in Italian, which is called terza rima, and what you did in blank verse, which I think most people realize is what Shakespeare wrote in?
Yeah, most people should. I don't know if it gets taught in schools anymore. Because of poetry.
I'm talking with Professor Tony Esselin about Dante. He teaches at Providence College. Go ahead, Tony.
Well, Dante invented the terza rima form precisely for the Divine Comedy because it was going to be in three books and it was going to have at its core a celebration of the Holy Trinity. So we think of it as a Trinitarian verse. It's separated into little three-line blocks with interlocking rhymes so that the first and third line of a block will rhyme and they will rhyme also on the second line of the preceding block, and this is a way to join block to block.
And the cantos, you have the same number of cantos in each volume, in each section, and are the same number of lines? They don't have the same number of lines, do they, in each canto?
No, they don't have the same number of lines. And Dante has 100 cantos in the whole Divine Comedy, 100 being a perfect square and the square of 10. There's a lot of numerological symbolism in the Divine Comedy. 10 is a very special number for Dante. Things change in Canto 10 in all three of the works. He couldn't divide 100 into three evenly because there'd be one left over. So he stuck the extra one, so to speak, onto Inferno. So the Purgatory and Paradise have 33 cantos. 33 is the number of Christ. It's thought that Christ was 33 years old when he died on the cross.
Now, is Dante thinking all this as he's structuring it?
Absolutely, absolutely, no question about
yeah.
it. And in fact, he's set it up so that Inferno doesn't have 33 cantos either, and it doesn't... See, Hell only begins in Canto 3 of the Inferno. So there, we can consider that book as having 34 cantos, which is too many, or 32 cantos, which is too few, but not 33. In other words, it's not worthy...
It's not worthy of Christ. It's not worthy of Christ.
It's also why the name of Christ and the name of Mary, they cannot occur in Inferno. You do not breathe the name of Christ or of Mary in Hell. They are referred to obliquely by paraphrase.
Now let's situate our discussion for our listeners. Dante was Italian. He lived in the 1300s or the 14th century during the Italian Renaissance. And he wrote these three sections of the Divine Comedy, which now I've just found out was called the Comedy originally.
Right.
Over what, about 10 years, 15 years?
Yeah, maybe a little less than that, yeah.
And so he's basically writing, what, in the first decade of the 14th century, is that correct?
The second, most of the second decade of the 14th
century. So
we 1321. He just barely finished Paradise before he died.
Really? How long did he live after he finished?
Oh, only a few months, I believe.
Really? Did he know he was going to die?
I don't think so. He was about 56 years old when he died. So unless he was in very ill health, probably was one of those things that happened to men in their middle age that
stop.
You stick. I don't know, right?
Hey, what kind of family was Dante from? Dante Alighieri, was he from a well-to-do family? In Florence?
Yeah, fairly well-to-do. We would consider them upper middle class. He makes claims in the Divine Comedy that he's got noble blood. His great-great-grandfather was raised to the knighthood by Emperor Conrad for his valor in the Crusades. He accompanied the Emperor Conrad, and that emperor appreciated his derring do and raised him to the knighthood. So Dante claims aristocratic blood.
So he received then the best education available probably anywhere in the world. Florence in the 14th century, where would you get a better education?
Paris. Paris, you'd get a better education. Bologna, Cologne, you'd get a better education. Oxford.
All better than Florence.
Yeah.
He got obviously a very rich humanistic education.
Well, yeah, he was a genius. He knew all of Italian literature, no question about that, but the people in northern Italy and Tuscany, a little further south, they had constant mercantile transactions with people from France and people from Provence and Spain. And so somebody like Dante would also naturally have read Provençal and French.
That is, for our audience, Provençal French was the seat where the birth of the love song came from, the troubadour poetry.
Yeah, that's it. And he's read all those Provençal poets in the original language. We even meet a Provençal poet in Purgatory, Arnaud Daniel, and Dante has him speak in Provençal. It's like as if Dante writes his own little Provençal poem.
And what wasn't there a sniff of heresy in that region?
There was a lot of heresy in that region in the old days, and that's why Saint Dominic got the idea that the people there in Provence, in southern France, needed to be preached to because they had adopted the old recrudescence of the old Manichaean heresy, that is, that matter is evil, and matter was created by an evil principle, an evil god, whereas the good god is...
The thing that we thought Augustine put it into, he didn't.
Yeah.
Now, what I've wanted, everybody's heard about Dante and Beatrice.
Right.
But yet you have here this profoundly Christian Catholic poem, this about salvation and damnation and preparing to meet the beatific vision.
Right.
Could you put together for us what almost, to just a bystander, looks like a split personality, a guy who gets a crush on a woman he can't have and a guy who writes this epic poem about salvation?
Yeah, well, the man on the street seems to have forgotten the whole story of salvation is a story of love. And so to medieval man, it would be quite appropriate to conceive of these things together. This is not just the genius of Dante. We see it in the Cistercian writers. So we see it in St. Bernard of Clairvaux, very important influence upon Dante. And he's a couple of centuries before Dante. The idea is simple that all love comes from God. All love that is ordered in a true way. Now, we're not talking about disordered love of money, you know, avaricious people or people who are adulterers who misuse the passion of sexual desire. But we're talking about a noble love that Dante seems to have conceived for this girl, Beatrice, when he and she were very young, when they were 9 years old. And it never seems to have been...
Did they ever actually get to know each other?
I don't know. We from the Vita Nuova, we would say no. They hardly ever spoke. That she became an ideal for him, almost a window onto divinity, a mystical kind of love that he had for her. So
he did not have physical desire for her?
It doesn't seem so. If he did, he hasn't expressed it anywhere, not even in La Vita Nuova. In fact, when he first sees Beatrice, very comic, in the beginning of La Vita Nuova, he goes home and the different parts of his soul start talking to each other in Latin.
And it's like a Woody Allen movie.
A little bit. The belly, the seat of the appetite, and that's not just the appetite for food and drink, but the appetite for sex, the belly whimpers and complains, oh my gosh, from now on I'm going to be thwarted all the time. So the vital spirits speak to the spirits of the eyes and says, they say, now your beatitude has appeared.
Your happiness.
Your bliss. It's beatitudo, right? And that's
right.
Loaded theological word.
Right.
She sees this pretty girl. He's only a boy. Aparuit yam beatitudo vestra, your beatitude has appeared. But a few moments later, the belly grumbles and says, oh, gosh darn it, from now on I'm going to be thwarted all the time. So it does seem to have been a love, an admiration, that did not have sexual union as an aim.
I'm talking with Professor Tony Esselin from Providence College about Dante's Divine Comedy, a poem he's translated and is in a modern library edition. Tony, I have to ask you if you've done what I did on my sabbatical. When I was teaching, I got my first sabbatical in about the mid-80s, and I went to Italy, and I went to Florence. By the way, I was writing a book on happiness at the time. And I sat at the very place where Dante saw Beatrice, supposedly,
right,
while the sun was coming down. I just had to do it. Now, did you do that?
No, I didn't do that.
Why not?
I don't know.
Isn't the bridge St. Trinita?
With my wife and kids, I had this.
Well, I was single at the time.
Well, when I was single and I went to Italy twice, I was only 23 and 25, and I don't think I had any... I don't think I had any idea then that I would end up translating Dante.
Ooh, so you came to you late. I might ask you about that later. So read to us the opening stanzas of the Inferno. They're very famous. They're very famous lines there that have been used in literature ever since. They pop up in writers like Walker Percy and other places. Read us your translation.
I'd rather read the Paradise opening, but here's
well, we'll here's, get to that. We got to start in hell to get to Paradise.
All right. I'll read the first four stanzas. They fit together. Midway upon the journey of our life, I found myself in a dark wilderness, for I had wandered from the straight and true. How hard a thing it is to tell about that wilderness, so savage, dense, and harsh. Even to think of it renews my fear. It is so bitter, death is hardly more. But to reveal the good that came to me, I shall relate the other things I saw. How I had entered, I can't bring to mind. I was so full of sleep just at that point when I first left the way of truth behind.
Now read it in Italian.
Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diretta via era smarrita. Ai, quanto a dir qual era e cosa dura esta selva selvagge, aspre e forte, che nel pensiero rinnova la paura. Tante amare che poco e più morte, ma per trattar del ben che vi trovai, dirò delle altre cose che vi scorte. Io non so ben ridir come venturai, tanto era pien di sonno a quel punto che la verace via abbandonai.
Well, you can hear the music of it, and my sabbatical Italian is way behind me now, but I did pick up a little of that. And
I tell my students, I read the passages from it in Italian all the time. I said, the Italian is so beautiful, it makes even hell sound good. God in his great mercy does not allow German to be spoken in hell, because it would be adding insult to injury. But can you imagine?
That's too good.
It's just a silly joke.
But, you know, the thing that pops to mind, I think, for the first reader or the first listener of those opening stanzas, is Dante the poet talking about Dante himself? Is this narrator Dante?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that he is recounting a time in his life that he now looks back upon with some trepidation. He is confessing to have gone astray in his past. So it is semi-autobiographical.
Well, everyone goes astray. I mean,
yes, everyone does.
Did Dante go astray in some special way?
He doesn't actually name the sin so much as he categorizes it as a falling away from Beatrice, a falling out of love for Beatrice, which might mean that he had...
Well, he married someone else.
He married, yeah, but that was not part of the sin. That was not part of the sin.
I understand he had kind of an unsuccessful marriage, but we'll get to that later.
Well, it might be that he veered away from theology to a rather dubious philosophical path. For a while, the path of the Latin Averroists. It might have for him been an intellectual wandering, an intellectual sin. But in any case, he's every man here. That's why it's specifically located in the middle of the journey of our life. That is, he's 35 years old out of our allotted 70. He's got 35. And he's meant to stand for not just for himself as he was and still is, but also for you and me, for mankind, for everybody.
So the reader, the thoughtful reader, should think of themselves.
Yes.
As they're reading, and they should identify as this narrator.
Right.
And they should go on this journey for themselves. Is that right?
Yes. It's right. And in a way, the journey replicates the journey that all sinners do take when they are lost in the wilderness of the world with its many choices, all of which lead nowhere.
Now, in 2 minutes,
and they're saved by God.
In 2 minutes, we have 2 minutes left in this segment. summarize what happens in the Inferno.
He goes to New Jersey. That's the state motto. Abandoned.
You just wasted 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Sorry. What happens in the Inferno is that he learns about the dreadfulness of love that is rejected or love that is twisted. He learns about it because he meets the souls of those who, as Virgil puts it, have lost the good of the intellect. He meets the lost and learns.
But the sins of lust are at the very top. Why does he treat them so gently?
They're not treated gently. Because lust, of the seven deadly sins, of course they all kill you, but of the seven deadly sins, it's the least because it is the misuse of a very noble good. The love of the physical body. The physical body is a great and beautiful thing.
And they're consigned to blow around in a great wind.
A great tempest, yeah.
And are they going in circles? Are they blown in a circle?
Here, there, up, down, everywhere. In other words, just as they allowed their passions to take control of the reason and to, in life, just whisk them about hither and yon, now they are utterly helpless before the wind that does...
But Satan himself is helpless in a different way, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, all the souls...
Tell our listeners what Dante or what the narrator sees when he comes to the very bottom.
A monstrous anti-angel, encased up to his waist in ice, flapping his bat's wings forevermore, while in his three faces, his Trinitarian faces, he chews the betrayers of church and state, the great traitors in the world, Judas in the front mouth, head first, and Brutus and Cassius in the side mouths, feet first.
Boy, I wonder if he was riding now, who would be in those mouths. I'm talking with Professor Tony Esselin about Dante. He translated the Divine Comedy in a modern library edition. I'm Deal Hudson. This is Church and Culture, and what better to talk about than the greatest poet of all time, Dante. We'll be back in just a moment.
Just carry your cross. That's a phrase I've heard many times throughout my life, especially while complaining about unjust and unfair people. Most recently, I've been expressing my frustration regarding people who are difficult, mean, or downright bullies. And as I was sharing with someone an ongoing problem with a certain individual, my friend said to me, "Just carry your cross." Now, his simple comments really had me thinking. Perhaps God put me in the situation to bring me close to Him. And instead of constantly complaining about how this person has and continues to wrong me, perhaps I need to carry the cross in silence. Sometimes we need to bind our sufferings with that of Christ as we carry our own burdens. So the next time you have the urge to express anger or frustration, just stop the complaining and carry the cross. This has been a Christ-Centered Communication Message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, the Communication Evangelist.
Dozens of American Catholic leaders are urging us to read Al Cresta's Dangers to the Faith, Catholicism's 21st Century Opponents. Father Frank Pavone says,
"Dangers to the Faith is a must-have tool."
Bill Donahue added,
"Cresta debunks scores of myths, and his writing is a joy to read."
George Weigel concluded,
"Cresta scouts some of the roughest terrain on which the new evangelization must contend for the soul of the West."
Dangers to the Faith, at your local Catholic bookstore or wherever books are sold, or at AveMariaRadio.net.
Are you tired of the way your faith is represented in the mainstream media? Stop getting your Catholic news from secular sources and get it from a trusted local Catholic source instead. At the Michigan Catholic Newspaper, we're Catholic, and we cover your Catholic Church in a way that only Catholics could. For the same reason you listen to Ave Maria, get the Michigan Catholic for just $24 a year by calling 313-224-8000 or visit themichigancatholic.com.
Welcome back to Church and Culture. This is D.L. Hudson. I'm talking with Professor Tony Esselin of Providence College about Dante and his Divine Comedy. Professor Esselin, Tony, translated Divine Comedy in the modern library edition. So, Tony, we ended with the icy bottom pit of Inferno. And at that point, after going down, 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 our narrator goes up. And
right.
What does he find as he goes up?
Well, he finds himself on the shore of a beautiful mountain in the southern hemisphere. But before I tell you about that, there's one more thing we need to note about old Satan there at the bottom of hell, because it has to do with purgatory. See, Satan is frozen up to his navel in the river Cocytus, ice now. It's turned to ice. And what has turned it to ice is that Satan flaps his wings forever and ever and ever. He's always flapping his wings. If he didn't flap his wings, that ice would melt, and he'd be able to move. But because he flaps his wings, he raises this gale force wind, and that reduces the river to ice.
So he's too proud to stop flapping.
That's right. And the fascinating thing about it is that we naturally think of the beating of wings, the flapping of wings, as a sign of freedom. Birds taking off from the earth and flying upward. It's a crucial image in purgatory and paradise, this motion upward. And we as human beings are meant to fly upward in our souls towards God. But Satan's flapping his wings, and what he is essentially saying when he's doing this, he doesn't speak a word.
So there's no hell fire down there.
No fire but ice, which is worse.
Yes.
He doesn't speak the words, but he's saying, I am my own. I rise by my power. Right? My will is my own. My body is my own. I am my own. I rise. I rise. I rise by my power.
And by God, I'm not giving up.
And by God, I'm not giving up. And that freezes him in place.
It is a foretaste of Milton's Satan, is it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Milton, Dante sent Milton to school. Milton was wise enough.
And Milton and Dante sent Baudelaire to school, too, right?
Yeah, well, Milton was a better student.
Well, you know, T.S. Eliot called Baudelaire the greatest Christian poet since Dante.
Okay.
You're disagreeing. We'll talk about that on another show. I did my dissertation in part on Baudelaire. We can talk about it sometime.
Okay.
So he's now on the shores and looking up at a mountain.
Yeah. And there's the beautiful, clear, deep blue sky before the dawn above him. And it's filled with stars. And it's in the southern hemisphere, as it turns out, exactly opposite the globe of Calvary. And my students who encounter this for the first time are shocked. Because they're expecting a sort of low-carbohydrate hell. And I told them, no, purgatory is not low-carbohydrate hell. It is an entirely different realm. Purgatory is a deeply human place, as Dante conceives it, because it's where sinful human beings recover their natural humanity. It's an infirmary. It's a place where the sick are made whole and have youth restored.
Now, grace is perfecting nature at this point.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. Dante meets friends all up and down the mountain. They sing. There's no song in Inferno. There's not even rap music in Inferno.
Oh.
There should be rap
music
in Inferno.
Absolutely.
They hadn't been invented yet.
Yeah, and he would have put it there if it had been.
Yeah, but there's music. There's the singing of hymns and poetry up and down the mountain.
Now, did the mountain, does the levels of the mountain in any way parallel hell?
Yes and no. It's always with Dante. The answer is yes and no.
Yeah.
Each of the realms reflects the others.
But it's not perfectly. It's not perfect symmetry.
No, because that would be boring, and
it
wouldn't be enlightening.
And it wouldn't be Italian.
It wouldn't be medieval or Renaissance. When Dante is in purgatory proper, he's going to meet a lot of souls who don't yet get to atone for their sins because they were excommunicated or they waited until the moment of their death to repent. And so they're in a couple of levels outside of purgatory. And then come seven rings. You've got to imagine one of those old Italian mountains, and you've got to wind the road around the mountain to get up to the top of the mountain like a corkscrew. And each terrace, each ring, is where one of the seven capital vices, one of the seven deadly sins, is purged away. Not so much the actions that we did on earth, they're forgiven already. But when we do evil on earth, it has an effect upon our souls. It tars them. It messes us up, and so this is the place where we've got to be scrubbed clean. And he meets the souls of the proud, the envious, the wrathful, the slothful, the avaricious, the gluttonous, and then the lustful, taking each of the seven deadly sins in turn, all the way on up.
And they're being burned away? I mean, well, I shouldn't say burned away. They're being worked. How are they being removed?
Well, in different terraces, in different ways, appropriate to the particular sin. So in the terrace of pride, the prideful move round and round the circle for centuries sometimes with enormous boulders on their backs so that they can bow and bend their necks as they would not do on earth, okay? They bear these heavy burdens in humility. I should say also that there is suffering in purgatory, but it's not the suffering of the souls in hell, because there is always joy underlying the suffering in purgatory. Purgatory is a realm of hope. These are all blessed souls. They are all saved. There is no chance that any one of them will go to hell. They have all been saved. They are all blessed.
Well, I'll reflect my Protestant past right now and say, wait a minute, if they're saved, why do they have to go through this?
Because they are the kinds of creatures that we are, right? Let's suppose I spent my whole life being a vengeful backbiter, causing a lot of harm from a lot of people, taking delight in speaking badly about people behind their backs, telling secrets that ought to be kept to myself and so forth. Well, I repent of this before I die. I'm sorry I did those things. But I'm still the person who did that. So to speak, my soul walks with a really bad limp. And so to speak, my head is still twisted in one way, you know. And okay, I'm saved, but I'm still kind of a wreck.
And you're not ready for prime time, or you're not ready to see God. How do you want to put it?
Right. I need to go to the infirmary. Right. I need to be straight.
Now, is this? I'm going to ask another Protestant question. Is this scriptural?
Yeah, I think so.
I know that. Which book where it talks about Christ descending into hell? We know that, but
yeah,
we'll talk some other time about the idea of where purgatory comes from. But basically, it is the purgation of whatever sins you are taking with you from this life to the next.
It's the purification. That's what purgation means, right?
Right.
It's the purging away of the effects of the sin. Okay. Sin has already been forgiven, and now we are cleaning it up. You need to engage in some purifying suffering for those sins, but it's not as if it's simply a payback, right? There's something wrong with you still. You're not, as you said, you're not ready for prime time. You're not whole yet. You're not healed yet fully. Yeah, you're forgiven. You're going to be fine. But you need to go through the sick house, and what's more, the souls actually want this. The souls both suffer and at the same time are deeply willing to suffer. Dante makes it very clear that at any moment, any of those souls, any one of them, could just climb up the rest of that mountain and be done with it. But they
don't want to do that.
They wish to do that, but they don't will to do that, because they will to do only what they sense God wills them to do, right? And when they finally have it somehow revealed by a thought, an inspiration, a feeling, who knows, that in fact it's time, then they go. And then all the souls on the mountain shout for joy, Gloria in excelsis Deo. And the mountain shivers for joy. It's like an earthquake when one of the souls is liberated in this way.
Now,
purgatory is the place where you find your freedom again.
Is at this point the narrator, he still has a guide, but doesn't that guide change somewhere in purgatory?
Yeah, Virgil's his guide. And Virgil
is, of course, the poet who wrote the Aeneid, Roman poet.
And it's the best that human reason can do on its own without divine revelation. And it can do quite a lot. Virgil leads Dante all the way up the mountain of purgatory, and at the top of the mountain of purgatory is earthly paradise. Virgil even stays with Dante for a while in that earthly paradise.
That's where all the philosophers are, right?
No, no. There's in earthly paradise. There's nobody.
There's nobody. Where were the Greek philosophers? I forgot. It's been a while.
They were in the first circle of hell, where there's no punishment.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that was an odd. That was an odd place. I remember. I didn't quite know how to explain that. But so there's nobody in earthly paradise. Why not?
Well, it's where we would have been if Adam and Eve had not sinned.
If we had not fallen.
There's a mysterious woman named Matilda, who is a kind of a bridge between Virgil and Beatrice, who speaks to Virgil and Dante and another poet who is with them, Statius, about the place that they're entering and, you know, what it was and why it's here. And she prepares Dante to meet Beatrice. When Beatrice does appear, that's when Virgil has to leave. And Beatrice takes over as Dante's guide.
What do you think? Was it inevitable that Beatrice was going to play this role of, is it fair to say, mediator?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, is this then reflect what Dante, the person, thought, actually how he regarded Beatrice?
Well, he seems already to be regarding her in that light in La Vita Nuova, and that's a fairly youthful work. So he may have had this kind of thing on his mind for a long, long time.
And one thing I remember from my reading is that the poet is constantly referring to her eyes.
Yes.
And there seems to be this special quality of her gaze.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, we are never told anything about how Beatrice looks. We are told only about her lips and her eyes. And that's the case in La Vita Nuova, too. We don't know what color her hair is. We don't know how tall she is. We don't know anything about her facial structure. We are only told about her eyes and her smile, her lips that speak and her eyes that see. And what Dante has done is focus his love intently upon this holy woman who sees, right, and who then speaks what she sees, whose smile is also a beacon of her love and her joy. It's mystical and thoroughly intellectual at once, right? And what it's not is familiar. Beatrice can't just be for us, you know, the girl next door. She's the one who essentially sees things and imparts knowledge if we have ears to hear, and loves if we have hearts that will accept love.
Is it fair to call this Marian?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Beatrice would never be, it was Beatrice who got Virgil to go help Dante. Dante's lost in the wilderness at the beginning of the Inferno. But Beatrice would never have done that if Mary had not seen.
How would you describe the relation symbolically of Beatrice to Mary? Because Mary is going to enter pretty soon. I mean, going to enter at the very top of paradise. How do you describe that?
Well, there's a kind of chain of mediation. Think of that wonderful verse in the letter to the Hebrews, which says that we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. We can also say we're surrounded by a great cloud of intercessors. People who love us, who are praying on our behalf, people who have gone before us, people who we might have known in life, people who we didn't know in life but are looking after us in some way, your great-great-grandfather, perhaps. It's Mary who pleads on behalf of Dante first, and then Mary sends Santa Lucia to Beatrice, who then goes to Virgil, who gets Dante out of that dark woods at the beginning of the Inferno and then leads him through hell and up Purgatory Mountain.
Read us the opening to Paradiso, to Paradise.
Okay. In English?
First in English.
The glory of the one who moves all things penetrates the universe with light, more radiant in one part and elsewhere less. I have been in that heaven he makes most bright, and seen things neither mind can hold, nor tongue utter when one descends from such great height. For as we near the one for whom we long, our intellects so plunge into the deep, memory cannot follow where we go. Nevertheless, what small part I can keep of that holy kingdom treasured in my heart will now become the matter of my song.
Why does he say memory cannot follow?
Well, he's just a human being on this earth now. And he's constrained with a body that's not yet a glorified body. He's not right before the presence of God. Any experience of God is, it's just boundlessly overflows any container that we are. And that will continue to be the case.
Finite mind meets infinite being.
Yeah. Finite mind that is somehow yet Capax Dei, capable of apprehending God. But now finite being, still marred by sin, in a dying body, okay, trying to recover something of an experience which cannot be put into words.
Now from a literary point of view, do you think the Paradiso is exciting to read as the first two parts?
Well, if by exciting you mean, do you meet people who are going to be boiled in tar or have their heads lopped off every time they walk around a ring, or that are plunged up to their eyebrows in excrement and things like that, the answer is no. But if we feel the passion for truth that Dante felt, and if this is an adventure in vision, then it is as exciting as the other. It's more exciting than the other two.
You know, when I wrote my book on happiness, Tony, I'm talking, by the way, with Professor Tony Esselin of Providence College about Dante's Divine Comedy. I came across a quote from the French novelist Henri de Montholon, where he said, "Happiness writes white."
Wow! Yeah, that's very nice. Yeah. Well, Dante says over and over in the Paradise, "I do not have words to express what I saw. I'm like a baby who still wets his tongue at his mother's breast. That's what I'm like. I got to give up. My pen skips a beat." He, over and over, he says things like this.
But yet, it's just as beautiful to read. But it's beautiful in a different way, isn't it?
It's more beautiful. I think it's the greatest of the three, and one of the reasons why it's the greatest of the three is that it alone completes the other two. Hmm. The other two parts of the poem broach questions that are only resolved in Paradise. So Paradise brings to dramatic conclusion all of the action that had gone before in Inferno and Purgatory. So it's not only got to be coherent and wonderful and completed in its own right, it's got to be the thing that completes the whole poem. It's just amazing.
How does Dante go about ranking people? I mean, there are obvious kind of ways of doing it in Inferno and Purgatorio. How does he rank who's at the lower part and who's at the higher part of the Paradise?
In Paradise, there's the main division in Paradise is between those souls whose hearts were set completely on God, the greatest of the saints, and those people, the rest of us, whose hearts were not set completely on God while they lived, but though they lived good lives, were, for instance, some of them maybe too much attached to worldly honor, some of them too much attached to the pleasures of the body.
You mean still attached or were attached?
Were attached.
Okay.
Some of them, the lowest of the souls in Paradise, did not keep their religious vows, but succumbed to a compulsion. They were driven out of the convent. We meet a woman who had been a nun, Dante's sister-in-law, actually, who had been a nun but was forced out of the convent to marry against her will, right? Picarda is her name, and she's with these other souls who did not fulfill their religious vows, who have the dwelling circle of the moon, symbolizing changeableness, and they have the lowest rung of heavenly blessedness.
So it reflects earthly sanctity.
The shadow of, Dante puts it, that the shadow of Earth falls upon these planets.
Yes.
Right? At the sun and beyond the sun, the shadow of Earth does not, the Earth doesn't eclipse you then, because you're past all of that, astronomically. And Dante is using that astronomy to give us a division in these souls, and yet, all of the souls, all of them, they do not actually dwell on the moon or Venus or Mars. That's all symbolic, Dante explicitly says. It's all symbolic. They all dwell in the presence of God. They are all fully blessed. They cannot be blessed more than they are blessed.
You know, when Dante reaches the end, toward the end of his journey, just like the opening of the Divine Comedy, which you read earlier from the Inferno, this scene is really famous as well, where he talks about love in the universe, and he talks about its relationship to God. And walk us through the final moments of his journey and underscore maybe some of the most famous passages that are there.
Okay, well,
I know that's a tough one. But
yeah, it's a tough one. The most famous line of all is the final line, beyond which we can't go, the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
Now, what does he mean when he says the love that moves the sun and the other stars? What's he mean?
God. God is the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
He moves by attracting them or pushing them?
Both, and by indwelling. God is their cause by way of efficiency. That is, he causes them to move, but he's the cause also by way of attraction.
Final cause. Says,
right? And he's
first cause.
Sustains them all. He dwells.
He's by participation.
Yeah. And when Dante has reached that point, he is himself like one of the planetary spheres. He is, so to speak, also revolving perfectly, in perfect balance around God, around the sun that moves the love that moves the sun and the other stars. Dante is there, finally in the presence of God. This is the beatific vision. Beatrice is not any longer with him. She has left him. She has resumed her place in the heavenly hierarchy. Saint Bernard of Clairvaux is the one to bring him to the...
Yeah, when I first read the Divine Comedy, that kind of caught me by surprise.
Yeah. Well, it's direct, love-inspired, mystical vision taking over, where theology, which is our reasoned attempt to understand revelation, theology has to say, I can't go any farther than this. But love can understand what even theology...
And when Maritain was
standing knocking at the door.
When Maritain was to address this in his degrees of knowledge, he used St. John of the Cross, but St. John of the Cross hadn't come around yet.
No, but he had read his Paradiso. St. John had. No question about that.
Time's going so fast talking about this. We have about a minute left, Tony. I'm talking to Tony Esselin about Dante and the Divine Comedy. If someone were to put the question... Or let's say the Flannery O'Connor question to put a gun to your head and say, what is the most important reason to read the Divine Comedy? What would you say?
The most important reason...
To read it.
To read it is to be so enthralled by its beauty that you, too, will take at least one more toddling step towards that love that is the meaning, the beginning, and the goal of all things.
That's a good answer, Tony.
It's a
very Dante-esque answer. And in other words, it will help us in our journey.
It's meant to.
He did mean this to be a work of art to help us toward God. He meant that. He intended that. Is that correct?
Yeah, no question about it.
Tony Esselin, professor at Providence College, translator of Dante's Divine Comedy, author of many other books, which I would like to talk about at a future date. Thank you for being on Church and Culture.
Thanks, Steele. It's been a great delight.
You're listening to Church and Culture. Coming up next is Bob Riley, the author of Surprised by Beauty, A Listener's Guide to the Recovery of Modern Music.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those that find it are few. This verse from chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel is one of the hard sayings of Jesus. Jesus couldn't be more clear, and yet we want to believe what the world says. Broad is the way to heaven, and almost everyone gets there. Narrow is the way to hell, and hardly anyone ends up there, maybe serial killers. This idea of universalism, that everyone will be saved because they are good people, is just the opposite of what our Lord is saying in the gospel. We can use this idea to justify our lack of evangelization. If everyone is going to heaven, why bother? But if Jesus is serious, it's time for us to become the witnesses we were created to be.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
On the next Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Apologist Marcellino D'Ambrosio helping us prepare for Lent. Our Bible Lady Gail Buckley has our scripture verse for the week, and we'll take a look at the growing problem of TV violence with the Parents Television Council.
Catholic Connection, weekday mornings at 8 a.m. on 990 WDEO.
Christopher Minutes, thoughts on making every day count. I'm Frank Sweeney.
Operation Christmas Child is an organization that brings presents wrapped in shoeboxes to kids overseas. One of the homes visited by the nonprofit group was the Dula family in Croatia. Though the war had ended a decade earlier, this family of seven children and their widowed mom still feels the effects through poverty and unemployment. A member of the group recalls, "It's amazing that through a simple shoebox, Jesus can give significance to a child who feels unloved." So, my friend, share God's love with those who are in need.
This message was brought to you by the Christophers. Thanks for listening, and remember that it's better to light one candle than curse the darkness.
Is love just about cutting up paper doilies and coloring valentines? Do Valentine's Day projects belong in your homeschool after the elementary years? Well, this week on Homeschool Heartbeat with your host, Mike Smith, our guest discusses love's rich heritage through literature.
This week, our guest is Dr. Jean Edward Beath, author, former World Magazine culture editor, and provost of Patrick Henry College. Dr. Beath, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
This week, we want to provide a Valentine's Day theme for homeschoolers with older students. A unit study on various portrayals of love in literature is right up your alley, Dr. Beath. So let's start this unit study at the beginning. The Greeks. Would you tell us about some of the famous couples in the stories of Homer? What's so remarkable about them anyway?
Well, one of the most romantic scenes in all of literature is probably when Hector, who's the big hero of the Trojans, meets with his wife, Andromache, and their little son comes up and tries to play with his helmet. And in that scene, Hector says that where everybody else is fighting for honor and for revenge and all these other